A couple of years ago at an L.A. comedy club, the Comedy Central star Daniel Tosh got in a lot of trouble for joking about rape during a live stand-up set. In the uproar that followed, people responded through blog posts, articles, tweets, but Patricia Lockwood used poetry. It took her a while, but after a year, she published her poem, called Rape Joke, on a website called The All. It seemed to undermine each side of the argument, managing to be both funny and absolutely heartbreaking. And it also immediately went viral, probably a first for a 1,200-word poem. At age 32, Patricia Lockwood is making a big splash right now in the poetry world. She's got a new book of poems called Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland Sexuals. And she is here with me now. Patricia Lockwood, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you.
So, before we talk, can you read the first few stanzas of Rape Joke?
Yes, I can do that. Rape Joke. The rape joke is that you were 19 years old. The rape joke is that he was your boyfriend. The rape joke, it wore a goatee. A goatee. Imagine the rape joke looking in the mirror, perfectly reflecting back itself, and grooming itself to look more like a rape joke. Ah, it thinks. Yes, a goatee.
Did you have any idea when you wrote that poem that it would make anything like the splash that it did?
No, I don't think anyone writing a poem has any sense that it's going to make any sort of a splash.
Yeah.
More important, it's good not to be thinking about that when you're writing them.
So after it created this huge splash and after being a normal, obscure poet writing poetry for a decade or more, and then you became literally overnight as famous as a young living poet can probably be, was that discombobulating or delightful?
It was a little bit discombobulating. I will say that the level of fame a poet can reach in this country is not very high.
Right.
I'm about as famous as, you know, like a local used car dealership owner, maybe, if that. I mean, they used to be athletes, so probably not even that high.
But we're talking about relative fame. You're famous for a poet.
It is relative. That's true. And it is discombobulating because you're not expecting any of it. And poets generally work pretty much in an insulated, very solitary environment. So it can be interesting to have all that feedback resonating at you when you're trying to do this very sort of private practice.
Right. Most of your poetry that I've read is funny, some of it very funny, but not in the way people might think of funny poetry, not in that light verse
right.
way.
It's not stand-up poetry. That's
right.
What I call it.
Is that part of your mission as a poet to sort of prove that real poetry doesn't have to be super earnest necessarily or morose or lugubrious or any of those things?
It's actually a challenge that I've sort of set myself. I would say that my baseline voice when writing poetry tends to be very serious, very grave. But in my actual, you know, life, my interpersonal relationships, I tend to be a funny person. So it was a challenge that I set myself to try to integrate those two voices.
Right. Well, and you tweet prolifically, an average by my count of nine a day since you joined Twitter.
Do I tweet nine a day?
That's what I figured, yeah.
That's high.
You joined only 3 years ago, well into Twitter's existence. So was tweeting a kind of training wheels for this merger of the colloquial and the poetic that you're talking about you've arrived at?
For the merger, yeah, because when I go to Twitter, I'm generally going to say something funny. I'm not going to say something super, super serious, but it's also very literary. So I was doing something there, and I thought it would be possible to carry that over into my poetry. In my poems, people do talk a lot about how I'm a pop culture poet, but I think if people actually go to the poems themselves, there's not as much evidence of that. Whereas in my tweets, I will straight up tweet about the Kool-Aid man, and I'm not necessarily going to do that in a poem.
Right.
So I think that the idiom shifts a little bit, the vocabulary shifts, and the characters shift.
But it sounds – the way you're describing the differences, though, it sounds like they are siblings or cousins, that it's not an entirely other thing.
Yes, they're related.
Yeah.
They are related. Again, it's there's a punchline in poems, whether it's funny or whether it's serious.
Right.
It's still sort of that, you know, sock it to the people at the end.
There are inevitably critics, or at least one that whom I read on the New Yorker website, who seems to think your tweeting is an unhealthy habit, that it makes you play to the peanut gallery too much. What do you think
right.
of that?
Which is interesting. You know, no one thought in the past that writers of short stories were just only shut up in their studies all day writing these short stories. They went out at night and they talked to each other about short stories. That's what we're doing now on Twitter, but it's just in a place where everyone can see it, I think.
So instead of the Algonquin Roundtable or wherever poets gather, now
this is our Algonquin Roundtable.
You've written a bunch of tweets that you call sects, S-E-X-T-S. They are surreal and sort of impossible come-ons, and I wonder if you would read a couple or three.
Sure. I am a water glass at the Inquisition. You are a dry pope mouth. You pucker. I wet you. I guess the number of gumballs in a jar. I'm off by just one gumball. I'm pink, it whispers, and then leaps into my mouth. I am a living male turtleneck. You are an art teacher in winter. You put your whole head through me.
Those are wonderful and funny, and they do this funny simultaneously, which is to sexualize everything on Earth.
Everything, popes.
But make that very idea seem ridiculous.
Yeah.
And speaking of funny and confusing and vaguely sexual and seemingly impossible things, your father is a married Catholic priest. How did that happen?
Weird. It's like, how did I even get born? Well, here's how it happened. So he was an atheist. Then he joined the Navy, the submarine service, and he converted under the sea. And so he says, I think that I would like to be a Lutheran, and I think that I would like to enter seminary and study to be a minister. So that's what he did. And for a little while, he was a Lutheran minister. And he was like, wait, this isn't hardcore enough, I guess. And so he said that he was going to convert to Catholicism. But there's a dispensation that the church offers in these sorts of situations where a married minister of another faith converts, you get the option to become a married Catholic priest. It's very rare, although it's going to become, I think, a little more frequent now.
Not to focus on your father so much, but he sounds like a fictional character. He went around the house in his cassock and naked sometimes and played the blues guitar and watched old B-movies. Those are all true?
Oh, yeah. Well, they weren't even necessarily B-movies. He really, really liked Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Uh-huh.
But the fact of the matter was you only ever saw him either almost nude in a large pair of tidy whities or just in full Catholic regalia, like gold-trimmed robes and pom-pom hats, that sort of thing. That can really do a number on a girl.
It's really – you grew up in the Wes Anderson movie I haven't seen yet.
Yeah, I don't know that he'd be capable of making that movie.
Did you start reading and liking poetry as a little girl?
Maybe not little, because we didn't actually have a whole lot of literature in our house. But we had a lot of theology, and then we had a lot of Tom Clancy. So the sort of literature that was available to me came later when there was a school library, when I could have teachers sort of guide me in different directions. In my home, it was not so much of a reading home.
You've said an interesting thing about being a kid and about how you didn't feel particularly girlish or boyish. You said you were the 11-year-old gender protagonist. What did you mean exactly?
If you grow up reading, you're inserting yourself into the minds of the narrators. And you have no difficulty if it's some boy who's living in a hollow tree, you know, in some survivalist fantasy or, you know, like some young kid in a dystopia somewhere. You're just inserting yourself into the viewpoint of the books. And you just come to see yourself as something that transcends gender or that's above those things. Now, I think that young boys don't read as many books where girls are the narrators. So I think that maybe they don't develop that skill in the way that we do.
I read Nancy Drew religiously, so I think
I did.
Did
you like Nancy? Were you a Trixie Belden guy?
No, I was a Nancy guy.
Yeah, I was going to say there's either a Nancy or a Trixie.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
She's spunky.
Contemporary poets, whom we've heard of, teach usually at college and almost always have MFAs these days.
Yeah.
You don't do either of those things.
No.
Do you think that not having that background and not being part of that world is one of the reasons you are inclined to write poems for people outside that hermetic world?
I think that I had a weird voice to start with. I don't think that if I had done an MFA program that it would have beaten it out of me. I know that's the popular conception, but it is possible that I have a wider sense of who an audience can be because I didn't go to school. But otherwise, I would say I think that I ended up pretty much with the directness of tone and the sort of like weirdness of scenario that I would have had otherwise.
Right.
So I'm not sure that lack of schooling is what did it. Maybe the reason I didn't go to school is because I was weird too. You know, it might just all come back to weirdness in the end.
It may be, but and I'm not suggesting it beating it out of you exactly. But if one is young and one is writing mm-hmm. for one's fellow would-be poets yeah. and poetry teachers, it's got to affect the voice and the
– I think it definitely yeah. does. And I think the sway of influence can be a lot more subtle than we know. I was talking about it earlier. You can write to please a teacher. You can write to please who you consider to be the really excellent students in the class or your friends.
Right, right.
But, I mean, writing groups can do that too.
For sure.
That you can do that just reading too much of one author on your own.
Yeah. You married fairly young for these
yeah.
days. You were 21.
These degenerate days.
how does having what sounds like a very solid, splendid, supportive marriage affect or enable the writing you do?
Oh, it enables everything. I get to focus completely on the work. I make him shut up when he's home sometimes. I make him turn off his music. You know, it's just, it's not necessary. I'm the tyrant. And I think that we, looking back over a long history of writers, we're like, damn, they were not good people. They continue to not be very good people. But some people, you know, don't mind that as much. They don't mind, like, yoking their oxen to, you know.
Yeah, for now. But he, yeah. you know, he sounds like the kind of perfect, oppressed artist's wife of yore.
Oh, definitely. I just stomp on him. Yeah, all over.
There you go.
He's very oppressed.
And in the future, critics will demand that he get the credit he deserved, that he's been denied all these years.
I hope that there are conspiracy theories that happen in the future about how he secretly wrote it all.
There you go. Well, I really look forward to whatever you come up with next, and I am happy that you've achieved this super celebrity right now for a young poet.
Super celebrity.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, it's been wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Patricia Lockwood's new collection of poems is called Motherland, Fatherland, Homeland, Sexuals, and it is available in bookstores everywhere.